respond and wanting to do, may approach, and let's get everybody a moment to get in and out of court. That is Martin, the head of the place, may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Tyler Spahn, on behalf of the appellate, Ann Kelly, personal representative of the estate, Stephanie Kelly. This appeal presents one central question. Can a pro se complaint filed in a representative capacity be saved by timely action before the trial court to retain counsel and file an amended pleading properly prepared and signed by counsel that relates back to the original pleading? I believe present this issue as having a clear, easy answer that a pro se complaint in a representative capacity is a nullity. It never existed, and therefore there's nothing for an amended pleading to relate back to. Appellant concedes that Nebraska law has used the term nullity in describing pro se complaints in a representative capacity, and this court has upheld dismissals for unauthorized practice. However, the intent of this court in its prior relevant case law appears to be that a trial court should have discretion in dismissing for unauthorized practice, and that dismissal should be reserved for flagrant and persistent unauthorized acts. This is the better rule that gives the court discretion to apply the rule against unauthorized practice and dismiss when dismissal actually furthers the purposes of the rule. Those purposes were not furthered in this case. To provide a brief overview of the facts, Ms. Kelly filed a pro se wrongful death complaint as a special administrator of her husband's estate. The appellees are timely served. There is an indication in the record that she retained legal advice from a Rivera law firm. However, I don't know if that's clearly in the record. It's just a notation on the complaint, and the relevance of that is not really within the record. However, if the court were to consider that, I believe it actually is in Ms. Kelly's benefit, as it shows that she sought the advice of counsel and believed she could proceed in this action pro se.
Was it Nebraska counsel?
It was not. When Dr. Burwell filed his motion to dismiss, Ms. Kelly retained Nebraska counsel who filed a notice of cures only 16 days later, and then immediately moved to file an amended pleading, which would relate back to the pro se complaint. That motion was denied, however, based upon the district court's erroneous conclusion that the original complaint was a nullity, and therefore there was nothing for an amended pleading to relate back to. However, that conclusion was erroneous because this court has set forth in the Klaus versus Able Construction Company that dismissal should be premised on flagrant and persistent unauthorized acts. And this court expressly observed that dismissal is not required in all cases. However, the extent of the attorney's unauthorized acts in the Klaus required that dismissal be done. Then the next relevant case is Waite versus Carpenter, in which the Nebraska Court of Appeals again dismissed a pro se wrongful death action, but it premised dismissal on flagrant and persistent unauthorized acts. In contrast to those two cases, it would be 1 Nebat 321. I believe it's the final Waite versus Carpenter. I know there's quite a few. In contrast to those two cases, Ms. Kelly did not commit persistent and flagrant unauthorized practice. Any unauthorized practice in this case limited
your rule.
I think the court's, it would first be in the district court's discretion to determine whether the unauthorized practice is flagrant and persistent. But I think a good guide is in Klaus and Waite versus Carpenter, which shows that the unauthorized practice was vexatious to the defendants, caused unnecessary effort to the courts, and it was vexatious to the administration of justice. I think when it rises to that level where it's clearly unnecessary defendants, unnecessary complaints, they're not successfully stating a cause of action, then that would qualify as flagrant and persistent.
Counsel, the cases you cite were actually persistent and caused by action practice. Those cases really don't say that's the standard. You want us to adopt that as a standard here today. Those cases, all those cases are doing is saying under these facts, this is persistent.
I believe that's one way to read it. However, as Your Honor just phrased it, it was an abuse of discretion. I believe that the case law reflects the trial court has discretion in deciding whether to dismiss for unauthorized practice. And in this case, the district court...
Your position is if someone files clearly pro se in a representative capacity, the trial judge has discretion not to take action.
The trial court has discretion to permit that party to retain counsel and file an amended pleading. That dismissal of the proceeding is not an automatic result. And I believe that's supported by McClouse, which says dismissal is not required in all cases. To the extent that this court concludes that's not the Nebraska rule, I would urge the court to adopt that as a rule, as it's the better approach. Because the sanctions for an authorized practice of law should be proportional to the gravity of the harm that's actually caused. As demonstrated by this case, application of the rule and dismissal actually prejudiced only the estate, whom was a party the rule against unauthorized practice was designed to protect. And that's an illogical application of the rule against unauthorized practice, when the only party that is prejudiced is the estate and is prejudiced by the dismissal. The appellees were not prejudiced. They received timely notice within the limitations period, and the complaint successfully stated cause of action to be a negligent mental disorder received by accepting help. I would refer this court to the Supreme Court of Illinois' opinion in Downtown Disposal Services, which is cited in our brief, which basically set forth that discretion is the better approach. And as observed by that court, discretion does not increase the likelihood that these pro se complaints were proliferating, because judges dislike pro se litigation and will be vigorous enforcers of the rule against unauthorized practice. However, by granting them the discretion in deciding whether to dismiss, they can consider factors such as whether the non-attorney acted without knowledge, whether the non-attorney acted diligently to correct the mistake once it was brought to their attention, the actual extent of the unauthorized practice, and whether any prejudice resulted. And I believe that approach is consistent with Niklaus and Waite versus Carpenter, which went through a thorough analysis of the extent of the non-attorney unauthorized practice. Additionally, I don't believe there's anything in Nebraska law that mandates a pro se complaint in a representative capacity to be a nullity and the entire proceeding to be dismissed automatically. Appellees refer to Nebraska Revised Statute 7-101, which is the prohibition against the unauthorized practice of law. But that doesn't say anything about the effect of a pro se complaint in a representative capacity. It doesn't dictate that such complaints are a nullity and must be dismissed. That will be the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Mr. Snowden, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. I would like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for my colleague, Ms. Kathy Trent-Millen. Your Honors, I think there are several undisputed points that really determine the outcome in this case. Number one, it is undisputed, I think, that the plaintiff engaged in the unauthorized practice of law, and that a pro se complaint in the representative capacity constitutes the unauthorized practice of law. I noticed a little equivocation in the plaintiff's brief where they say they acknowledge that they may have committed the unauthorized practice of law, but the plaintiff surely did. In addition, I think there's it's beyond reasonable dispute that a law firm in Arizona, the Rivera Law Firm, committed the unauthorized practice of law. The statute in Nebraska, which is 7101, is very clear on what constitutes the unauthorized practice of law. It says that no person shall conduct or defend any action or proceeding to which he's a party, not a party, either by using or prescribing his own name or the name of any other person, or by drawing pleadings. One simply cannot look at the complaint filed in this matter, which lists, I think, 12 fictional Roman numerals for fictional defendants and ABC corporate defendants and XYZ partnership defendants, and is obviously a well-crafted legal document without realizing that with reasonable probability that came from the Rivera Law Firm. The summons in this case, the green card that get sent out for service and return, was signed by the Rivera Law Firm, which is not authorized to practice in Nebraska.
So what does that do to the equities in this case?
Well, there are equities. To the extent that the court would look at equities, I don't think it helps at all. I mean, it certainly indicates that this was a flagrant practice of the unauthorized practice of law. With regards to the unauthorized practice of law, the argument of the plaintiff seems to be that there should be some application of a proportionality argument. To me, that's arguing this is really not a big deal. But unauthorized practice of law is a big deal, and I think this court takes it seriously. It has created a commission on the unauthorized practice of law. There is a prosecutor that I know I had some contact with over this matter with regards to prosecuting instances of unauthorized practice of law. Opinions are issued on what constitutes the unauthorized practice of law. This is a very big deal. And I don't think it's appropriate to sort of argue that in the brief of the plaintiff, or to the extent they might argue, that if you don't catch it right away, that it's excusable. Ignorance of the law is no excuse, and the fact that occasionally lawyers and judges might not recognize immediately the unauthorized practice of law is no excuse or reason that once it is recognized, the court should exercise the remedy that this court in the past has prescribed, and I believe the statute prescribes. The statute goes on to say, no such paper shall be received or filed in any action or proceeding unless the same bears the endorsement of some admitted attorney.
What do you think of the Wisconsin approach, where they say, well, this is the statute of
Well, that seems to me it would violate our statute. I don't know how Wisconsin reconciles that with their statute, but our statute says every pleading has to be signed by an attorney authorized to practice in the state of Nebraska.
So this is not signed by an attorney,
the initial? The initial pleading in this case is not signed by an attorney, for sure.
I think Wisconsin really needs an analysis of the fiction.
Yeah. Now, how they do that when, if their statute was like ours and says no pleading like this should be filed, and it's the duty of the judges of such courts to enforce the prohibition, I don't know how, in view of that language, you come up with much of a discretionary standard at all. I mean, the statute clearly says that the clerk, if the clerk recognizes the unauthorized practice of law, they should not permit the filing. And it's the duty of the judges, once they recognize the unauthorized practice of law, to enforce the provisions of the statute.
Now, the court's authorized to reject the filing that is submitted to us.
That's an interesting question that I wish to my way of thinking, they would. And it would be a slippery slope, I think, for this court to try to enact criteria for a clerk to decide I'm going to let this one in because it's not because of some proportionality rule or because something was litigant or persistent, that'd be very difficult. I think the rule that ought to apply is that the clerk ought to hand it back and say, this doesn't appear to conform with the statute. This is the unauthorized practice of law. You're a pro se individual representing a party. Now, not everybody would be smart enough to do that, probably, as is referenced, I'm not criticizing the clerk, but obviously in this case, that didn't happen. Before I sit down, I would want to talk a little bit.
I suggest that Illinois has come up with some solutions about proportionality and discretion.
Well, respond to that. I respond that different courts come up with different solutions one time, sometimes, and they occasionally will try to mitigate a harsh result. But with our statute and with the case law that we have developed in Nebraska, I can't imagine how the court would fashion a criteria for determining flagrancy or persistence or proportionality that would be something that everybody could follow.
And it's a harsh result for these states.
I don't think it's any more harsh than the statute of limitations. The statute of limitations leaves people without a remedy and filing pleadings without the authority to do so, committing a misdemeanor under our statute, it doesn't bother me at all, frankly. It is a harsh result. Now, I've got a lot more I wanted to talk about, but I do want to give my colleague a chance to speak to the court. So, thank you.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Can you tell us, please, how many minutes you anticipate speaking to us?
I have 3 minutes and 25 seconds, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll give you 4 minutes.
Thank you. May it please report, my name is Kathy Trent Bowen, and I'm here representing St. Francis Medical Center. We are asking that the trial court order be affirmed. The complaint that Ms. Kelly filed was a nullity. That means that the law treats it as if it never existed. And that means that there was nothing for it to relate back to. And as a result, the statute of limitations ran the day that Ms. Kelly filed her complaint, and as a result, she left herself out of time. You know, as lawyers, we use the phrase null and void very commonly, and the terms null and void are almost treated as one and the same. And generally speaking, that's how Nebraska law treats a nullity. It is null and void. What the plaintiff and the appellant is asking me to do in this case is really treat it as null and voidable. They want to give the court some kind of discretion that otherwise doesn't exist under the law, and they're purporting that they're taking nuances and imprecise language from this court to try to argue that there's a discretionary standard that doesn't really exist.
Do we define nullity, or do we need to define nullity?
Actually, Judge, there is ample case law in Nebraska that defines nullity in terms of something that does not exist. And in fact, the very case law that deals with the unauthorized practice of law specifically says that we treat it as if it was never filed. In the case where appeals have been filed by somebody acting in a representative capacity who was engaging in the unauthorized practice of law, the court has said that basically they've stricken those briefs and they've treated it as if the appeal was never filed. And that is really the inherent issue. The appellant in this case is trying to treat the dismissal as a sanction for the unauthorized practice of law. And that is not what happened. The issue isn't whether the court sanctioned the unauthorized practice of law by dismissing the case. The issue is the legal effect of having a null complaint. And that really is the issue that this court has to decide. What is the effect of a null and void complaint? Because the case law is clear that that is what happens when you have the unauthorized practice of law. It is treated as a nullity. You know, to the extent that the appellant is trying to push this notion of flagrant and persistent, I agree with Judge Couch that is not the standard that this court has set forth. Although that is something that the courts have talked about and is one of the public policy reasons supporting the legal effect of treating it as a nullity, that is not the standard that this court has set forth. The dismissal is the legal effect of someone filing what is an invalid document in the court system. And I agree with Mr. Snowden that not only does Rule 7-101 prohibit the court from receiving those documents, it also requires the court to enforce the prohibition. And to the extent that they're asking this court now to adopt a discretionary standard, they've not in any way explained how that would comport with this mandate in 7-101 that the courts enforce that prohibition. In addition to the fact that what we're really talking about is the legal effect of the null and void document, there are other reasons why this court should affirm. First of all, Ms. Kelly sat on the rights, and equity generally does not favor one who sits on their rights. Mr. Kelly died in March of 2015. She was appointed a special administrator a few months later in August of 2015, and yet she waited until literally the very last day of the statute of limitations to file suit. And then when she did so, she chose not to use the Nebraska attorney that she had used who obtained the special administrator rights for her. Instead, she went out and conferred with an Arizona law firm that clearly is not authorized to practice in Nebraska, and then proceeded to engage in the unauthorized practice of law. When you take those facts into consideration, even if this court were to adopt some type of equity-based argument, I certainly don't think that the equities side in her favor. Again, she had an opportunity to get legal counsel, and that was one of the issues, that the court in wait specifically talked about when the Court of Appeals said, we are not going to save the plaintiff slash appellant from his own acts. Part of what the court said was he had ample time to go out and get an attorney and file the proper cause of action, and he chose not to do so. And that's exactly what Ms. Kelly did in this case. She had a Nebraska lawyer. She chose not to use that Nebraska lawyer and instead proceed on a pro se basis in a representative capacity. So we ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
He has a minute 38.
38 seconds. We'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to address the Waite versus Carpenter, I'm glad that the appellees raised that language because the Court of Appeals framed that issue as to whether Waite should have been given additional time to retain counsel as an abuse of discretion. If the entire proceeding is treated as null and void as a nullity, then there would have been no ability of Waite to retain counsel and somehow save the proceeding. The entire proceeding would then be null and void. And I would refer the court to Gendon versus Crapville on that issue, which is cited in our brief, which assessed the effect of a defective pro se wrongful death petition and found that an amended pleading could relate back and save that petition. Although that case did not address unauthorized practice of law, I believe the same principles of law are applicable in terms of lack of capacity.
One is null and one is discretion. File a complaint if you want to make a minimum, but you're authorized to file a complaint legally, that's one thing. If you're not authorized to file a complaint legally, then what does it relate back to if you're not authorized to file a complaint?
That's a very good question, Your Honor. And I think that's the same question that was against them, actually, because you had a pro se son who was not the personal representative and didn't have capacity to start the action, but still this court found that amended pleading would relate back. Satan versus Patmore. I'll check that for you. It's in our brief. Okay, thank you. Just to address the equities, Ms. Kelly timely retained counsel once we brought to her attention she could not proceed pro se. So we would ask this court to reverse and remand for further proceedings. I'll leave to amend.
Thank you very much. Court will now take a break to 11:15 of the act. 11:15. Thank you for your patience. Thank you.
I'm not making a guarantee that you
would you sit there on the ship? Towards the governor.
Away from
the
state.
Away from the state. Towards the governor. So. Thank you.
That's what I said.
Well, so this will be somewhere here.